Good evening and welcome to our fifth edition of The Wolf Whistle. Tonight we are joined by former right midfielder Gerry O'Hara, born in Wolverhampton, 11 appearances for Wolves, 9 starts plus 2 as sub. Gerry, good evening.
Good evening, Jason.
How are you?
I'm very good, mate. Thank you. Yeah.
Yes, very good, Gerry. I'll tell you what, Gerry, you're one I've obviously wanted to interview because I know you personally. I know what a good lad you are. And you've told me some great stories in the past. Many you probably can't repeat.
Yes.
Yeah, so
it might not be the time and place, Jason.
Exactly, but we're not drinking beer, so we should be all right, and I won't have to edit loads. But, obviously, born in Wolverhampton, so playing for your hometown club. Before we go into that, tell me about your sort of schoolboy football and how you got spotted by Wolves.
Well, schoolboy football was, I went to a Catholic school, St Chad's, and obviously you're playing against all the other schools and there are always scouts on the sidelines there and, through the first stroke, second, third year, you obviously then, if you're of any decent sort of standard, you get picked for the town side. And as it goes further, you get picked for the county side as well. And that's what happened to me. One of the first people I encountered in my school sort of football was Mr. Eves, Mel.
Mel Eves.
Mel was at Wolverhampton Grammar School and we used to have some wonderful tussles against Wolverhampton Grammar School. I always remember we used to play Bilston Grammar School and there was an outstanding young man there, Adrian James, whose brother was Steve James, who
right.
played for Manchester United. Adrian was an outstanding talent when he was younger.
And was that they both Wolverhampton lads?
Adrian was a Bilston lad.
Yeah.
Mel, I believe, originated from Wensbury.
Yes, Mel did.
I think he was living in Wensfield then. I think his father had a pub. But
the Red Lion?
Yeah, the Red Lion, that's right, yeah.
So the guy that played for Man United, he was from Wolverhampton?
Cosley.
All right.
They were from, yeah.
How did Wolves miss him?
I don't know, really. And he had a decent career at Manchester United, Steve James. But his brother, Adrian, played for England schoolboys, was a big boy as well, but outstanding talent and... And got signed on as the likes of myself. There was another lad, Kim Wassell, who went to West Brom. Adrian got signed by Coventry. And then obviously you're playing your intermediate and youth games against these sides and you meet up again. And but he just didn't push on, Adrian. He didn't develop physically, but he had a good career non-league. I came across Adrian again later on in my career at Worcester City. He joined us at Worcester City. He didn't stay very long, but he joined us again at Worcester City. So, outstanding. There were some outstanding boys then.
And I remember, just going back to Mel Eves, I remember a story you told me. He was so committed, wasn't he? I remember, you said, obviously, if you'd lose a game, you'd come off the pitch, you'd be disappointed. But Mel used to take it quite personally, didn't he?
Mel is one on his own. Mel is he's a different character. He's a genuinely nice guy, Mel. But he was different to your run of the norm dressing room guy. Mel joined later on as we signed apprentices and did all the dirty work, the jobs, etc. Mel actually came as a full-time professional, just turned up one for pre-season training one summer, and there's Mel sat in the dressing room, and I said, all right, mate, how you doing? And I said, oh, yeah, I've signed, and, oh, okay, then fair enough. And we were young professionals then, we'd done our apprenticeship and moved through, and, I'd encountered Mel from the age of 12, 13, I think some of the lads that were in the dressing room found Mel different, and Mel would he very, very intense. Mel, it meant so much to him, And I remember one game in particular, and we'd lost in the youth leagues somewhere, and we virtually had to chivvy him along to get dressed. He just sat there with the towel over his head, and he was distraught that we'd lost. But that was Mel.
Yeah,
we're all different, and
I know. Obviously, how committed he was. Actually, we're going to do an episode with Mel soon. But, Gerry, this is all about you. Now, obviously, to play for your hometown club, so you joined Wolves straight from leaving school in 1973. And you become a professional in 1970.
It would have been, I joined at 16, I was about 16 and a half. I'd have been 17 in the December. So that summer I joined at 16 and a half. I could have joined at the year before, but I decided to stay on and take my O-levels, and was glad I did. And then, you know, I got talked into by my parents, really, who said, look, if they're that interested in you now, stay on at school, take your O-levels, get something behind you, and, you know, they're, if they're still interested, then you haven't wasted anything. And that's exactly what happened. And so I signed at 16 and a half, and then you had, up until you were 18, you proved, you tried to prove yourself that you were worthy of a full-time contract. And luckily enough, Mr. McGarry must have seen something and signed me at 18.
And was your parents Wolves fans, Jerry?
Well, my parents are both Irish.
Right.
In fact, my father is 96, still lives. I mean, we were
96?
96.
So we've got you for a few years
still,
then, Jerry.
Still around, dreams. And believe it or not, I was born just about where the pizza counter is at Asda, right by the side of the ground. I was born in a road called Red Cross Street.
So literally right by...
I could look out and see the...
Phil Park's goal kick away, as they say.
Well, yeah, a bit more accurate than that.
he'd hit the Sainsbury's, wouldn't he?
With his left, maybe. And certainly not with his right. But
so that's how close she was actually born to the ground?
I was born literally within a quarter of a mile from the ground.
So your mum and dad being Irish, so it wasn't their club as such?
Not really. They weren't really football. My father, I can remember as a young man going over to Birmingham and watching my father playing Gaelic football. As all the Irish contingent used to, and I have to say, when I think back now, we used to be playing together. He struck a lovely ball, left foot and right foot. Because the Gaelic is just like a larger football, you're just allowed to punch the living daylights out of each other as well as. You know, as well as kick the ball, like, you know, but not a game I really fancied, I've got to be honest with you. But they were, as I said, both born and bred in Ireland, you know, so and I think that obviously the Irish sports were far more prevalent for my family than standard football.
And what brought them to Wolverhampton?
Well, my father came over in the straight after the war. He was, Ireland was a completely different place then. My mother came over. She was a nurse and did all her training at the Royal Hospital. They met over here. They didn't meet in Ireland. So straight after the war,
both Irish met over here.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And met at a dance right by the side of the ground as well. I mean, it almost seemed like fate that, or it was written in the stars that something would happen with the Wolves. But
yeah.
Stayed over here and never moved.
So you made your debut in 1976.
January 1976, I made my debut
against
Ipswich in the in a replay in the fourth round of the FA Cup. Believe it or not, Jace, that season I started my football in the third team. I didn't even start in the Central League that, and in fact, I only played 16 games prior to that in the Central League. I think I played the first month, 6 weeks of the season in the third team, and then came through and just had a bit of a purple patch in the reserves. Just started playing well. I think I was developing physically, and. I think when people talk about games being, or football being a game of luck and things like this, I always remember 1970, the first season I was there, we had over 60 people on the playing staff then.
Wow.
And for you to get a game in your first, as an apprentice in the reserves, you knew you were doing something right. And right at the end of that season, the first season, I played the last two games of that first season, 1973-74 season. I played the last two games of the Central League. I played at home against Bolton. And this was at a time where there was the coal strikes and the electricity strikes and things like that. So you didn't play any night games, you played in the afternoon. And this is what I'm talking about, where luck can play its hand. And I was sub, and I always remember it well. We were toiling out a typical end of season Central reserve team game, and we were playing in the afternoon. And Bill McGarry had been at the ground doing all his bits and bobs, and decided before I go home I'll watch the last 10-15 minutes of this game. And I think Brian Owen, who was running the reserves, brought me on for the last 10-15 minutes.
Good timing.
And I came on and I had an absolutely unbelievable 15 minutes. I hit the post, and then I went past the left back and I clipped one in, and Peter Weith buried it with an header, and we won 1-0. And McGarry always actually said to me, when he decided to talk to me, he always said, from that day on, you were always up there.
So from then, because you made your debut obviously a couple of years later, you actually stuck in his head.
He said to me then, he says, if I hadn't seen you then, I'm not sure whether, you know, he says, but from that day onwards, you were always in my thoughts, thinking, well, this lad's got something. And that's how lucky it can be.
So with a playing squad of 60 staff, you've got to think about the fact that there was obviously your first team, then your reserve team, then a C team.
Four teams we had, Jazz.
And the other thing was as well, you only had one sub at the time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So to get into the team was you know, so when you was in say the fourth team or the C team, if you like, I bet the dream of the first team still seems so very very far
million
away.
Miles away. Million miles away. I mean, you had a first team squad of probably 16, 17 then, or 18 of who anybody could possibly play. You know, and I mean, you're talking about the calibre of, you know, John Richards, Ken Hibbitt, Jimmy McCalliog, you know, I was a big favourite of mine. I loved Jimmy Mac. But you had, you know, then you had, I mean, Colin alluded, Frank Munro, world class.
Yeah.
Frank had had pace.
Oh.
World class.
Frank was...
You know, but there was so much, and we were, you know, it was a good club to be around. You got into good habits and things like this, and you had good professionals there. Mike Bailey was another one, outstanding captain.
And you've got to look at that team, and you've got to think, as you're coming through, you've got to think it's going to be difficult to break into this. And, you know, who are you going to knock out of the team to get your place?
Yeah, but I don't think you thought like that at 16.
Yeah.
At 16, I don't think you thought.
You just took the opportunities.
You were living the dream.
Yeah,
to be perfectly honest. You were at a professional. You know, for me, it was my hometown. You know, it was all I ever wanted. You know, and I'm a full time there, and I think it was drummed into you then that's when you formed your habits. That's when you could actually see, if you had any intelligence about it, you could see the way the training was structured. You know, we were all, you know, like pipe cleaners. You know, we had nothing on our legs, we had nothing on our upper halves. You know, and your training would be structured around, you know, well, we need to build him up and things like that. So it was, and I don't really think you thought about it then. I think as the, you know, as the seasons went and you came back and there was a certain pressure on you, you know, because you knew, it certainly from 16 and a half to 18, the pressure was on you, because if you hadn't done enough, then you wouldn't be offered a professional contract.
And then you're out the door.
Which was that was the first hurdle. The first hurdle was to, if you were an apprentice professional, you had to make sure that you procured a full-time contract.
You'd done enough to get a contract, absolutely. And then you worried about the first team.
And then you thought, right, from here on, you know, I've got to kick on there. Like, you know, but that was I'm talking about my personal, you know, I think I'm right in saying, I don't know by the time Colin and JP were, Johnny Purdy were playing, whether it was apprenticeship or whether it was, I'm not sure, but...
Yeah, there would have been, there would have been youth teams when John Purdy was playing.
No, there was youth teams. I'm not sure whether an apprenticeship, it wasn't only there to, as an apprentice professional, you were allocated your own jobs within the ground.
Okay, yes. So what was your jobs?
Oh, well, Jason, there were so many. After every couple of months, you were moved on to a different one. You'd have the first team dressing room, you'd have the away team dressing room, where you changed and You'd have the bathrooms, you'd have the clean up, you'd have making sure on a Friday. Friday was the big day where you got the ground ready. We never swept the stands. That was never like that. But it was all regiment. It was like being in the army. You were, you know, you couldn't go home on a Friday afternoon until your job had been inspected by old Jack Dowing or a couple of the others, and they'd say, well, yeah, okay, that's clean enough now, you can go home now, and things
and,
like that.
And this. I think that's the difference now in football, because the players aren't getting that grounding, and they're not being made to, you know, I've heard now they don't do boots, they don't do, certainly don't do dressing rooms.
Well, we had a I'll tell you a little story about it. We were always allocated to two professionals whose boots you did, and I always remember my first year, two professionals were Derek Doolan and Danny Hegan. Now, Danny was a size
five. Two staunch Irish people as well.
Danny was a size five and Derek was a size 15 or something like that.
Size five?
Now, I'm just emphasising the point that Danny's boots were half the size of Derek's. and I'll, at that time, we used to earn... You earned £8 your first year apprentice professional.
Yeah.
£8 and you paid your 56 pence national stamp. They used to take home £7.43. And Paz used to say to me, say, but it's all right at Christmas, because the professionals, they always, the first teamers, they always give you a Christmas bonus.
Winner.
I thought, well, okay, yeah, brilliant. And I think in about early December, I'd brought Danny's boots to him and put them down in front of him. Danny says, "Yeah, wee man." He says, "There's your Christmas box." And he gave me a fiver. Well, that was nearly my week's wages.
Yeah.
And I thought, crikey.
That's all right,
isn't it? Danny's giving me a fiver, what's Derek going to give me?
Yeah, goal scorer with all the goal bonuses.
Oh, anyhow, the week went on and I was bringing Derek's perfectly shined boots and laying them down.
Getting cleaner and cleaner and cleaner.
Honestly, it was like you could see your face in them. And I always remember, I thought, well, I've got to force the issue here now.
Yeah.
So I brings his boots and I put them down in front of him. And I go, "Yeah, Derek." And,
what was it, February by this point? <was it? laughs> Trees gone down.
It was June, I think. The sun was bearing down. I says, "Here you go, Derek. Here's your boots." And he was sort of like talking away as he was getting changed and almost dismissing me, you know. And so, "Derek, your boots are here. Look, see how shiny they are? Lovely. Deck the halls with boughs of holly. Just warning you, Derek, it's Christmas, you know." And he went, clicked with me, all right. So he's talking away, not even looking at me, and he took something out of his pocket and he put it down on the thing. There was a little ledge, I always remember it, there was a little ledge going around my ear then, and by the dressing room, and he put a 50p down. No,
even then it was tight.
I just looked at it, and I just thought, well... No, I'll just turn and I walked out, and he says, "Hey,
you left it.
I left it, and he went, "Hey." He says, "Hey." I went, "No, you're all right, Derek." I says, "I'm not that desperate." Well, the volley of abuse.
So how old was you at that point?
I was 16 and a half.
Going
on 30, 38. You know,
Derek Dugan's playing with.
He was a world's. You know, yeah. He was the
George
biggest,
Best, Northern
biggest
Ireland
star. You know, but
and you're not that desperate.
And he reminded me of it in later years. I can tell you, in no uncertain terms.
Brilliant. But, what sort of relationship did you have with Derek? Because once again, I've heard a lot of stories about Derek. Sadly, he's not here anymore for us to be able to interview him. I did actually see him once. There's a pub, I think it was the Shoulder and Mutton in Technology.
Yeah.
And he did a talk there, and I've got to say it was very interesting.
Derek was a very, very intelligent. He was a Marmite character, I think, Derek. I think you either loved or hated him. He was the biggest star at the time. He transcended the football to being on the telly, World Cup squad, the World Cup sort of panels and things like this. And I think whatever, I look at Derek and all I remember is he was such an icon at the time around the club. Then you know, he by his own admission, I would say he certainly wasn't without his flaws, and, but then and who of us can say we have, and but he was a huge presence at the club,
huge
and a big player, And I think that used to wind the Gary up as well. I think because Derek was so well thought of by everybody at the club, you know, and the fans in particular. I think Derek was bigger than McGarry ever was, you know.
We'll come on to McGarry in a minute, because obviously I know he was the one that made your debut. Very quick story about Derek Dugan. Now, with Derek, obviously he was chairman of the PFA. Mm-hmm. Did you know about the KT at Kettering Town when he was there?
I remember he was the first one that had the advertising on, didn't he?
So the way around it was, Kettering Ties it was. He put KT on the front of the Kettering Town shirts, and there was a circle around it. And when the league said, you can't do that, you can't have advertising on shirts, he said, no, it's our badge, KT, Kettering Town. And it was actually Kettering Tires. Mm. And from then, so he was a bit of a trailblazer, wasn't he?
Oh, he was, he liked a bit of confrontation, did Derek? He wasn't averse to creating a bit of controversy.
Yeah. You know?
But he was, I think back, and I never played in the first team with Derek, but I played a few reserve team games with him, and I remember watching him as a kid from the terraces, like Mel has said, and things like this, and I thought, I think because he was so good in the air, everything seemed to revolve around his aerial prowess.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I went and trained with him and seen him at close quarters. Derek Dugan was a great footballer.
Yeah.
Far better footballer, I think, than a lot of people gave him credit for. And quick, unbelievably quick, over 10, 15, 20 yards.
He was
lightning.
Rapid.
Oh, but in terms of ability, he was a far better technical player than I'd given him credit for as a young man watching him from the sidelines, you know, and we're actually training with him.
And seeing him close up. So, obviously, there were some big characters around the club at the time. Obviously, Bill McGarry gave you your debut. What sort of relationship did you have with Bill, Jerry?
Well, I don't think as a young man you had a relationship with Bill McGarry. I think Bill McGarry, he had your future in his hands at the time. I think that, you know, Bill... I met Bill many years, a few years later in Jersey after I'd finished at Wolves, and I spoke more to Bill one night in Jersey. He was over there with Newcastle, and I spoke more with Bill that night than I did in 5-6 years that I was there, and a half years. We were in awe. We feared Bill McGarry, the young professionals. When I made my debut in the first team, I was still in what was the young professional dressing room. We changed in the away dressing room.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, everyday training and things like this. And McGarry used to come out of his after we'd been training, he would come out with his towel round him. And he wouldn't go up to he wouldn't turn left up to the first team dressing room and have a bath. He would turn right and come down to our dressing room.
Right.
And you can imagine a room full of you know, hormonal teenagers, you know, all shouting and screaming and having the crack.
And then
as soon as that
gaffer
door opened, you could hear a pin drop.
Yeah.
And he would go, and he would. There was a big bath. There was three showers, and then there was these two single baths. And he always had his single bath port. And no one dared go in and have a shower while he was there. It was, a story I'll tell, which I feel soured my relationship with Bill McGarry, was we played, I think it was about my fifth or sixth game in the first team, and we played away at Ipswich. And Ipswich was his old club. And we were, although we were doing well in the cup, I'd played two games in the cup that season, and we were into the quarter final against Man United, but we were tanking in the league. We were in the bottom three, and we it was a Tuesday night. We went away to Ipswich to play away, and Bill was at the time he was on edge. He because obviously things weren't going very well, and we got beat 3-0 by Ipswich. Cut a long story short, and after the game, he said, no one goes out. We were stopping in Ipswich, and Kevin Beattie owned a nightclub in Ipswich, and he'd invited us all back there.
That's probably why you lost 3-0. You're thinking, right, we're on it.
And McGarry, Chungi, there was a huge row in the dressing room afterwards. Am I allowed to swear on here, James?
Yeah, of course you are.
well, at full time, and McGarry, to get out of the director's box into the dressing room, you had to walk out the ground and come back in. And McGarry had taken a volley of abuse from Ipswich fans. So by the time he got into the dressing room, as the game finished...
He wasn't happy.
He was absolutely seething. He came in, the language, he was calling us, and you needn't think you're going out tonight, you bunch of blah, blah, blahs, and all this, and we sat. And he'd been like that at half-time, and we were 2-0 down at half-time, and if Bill had been a bit more controlled and a bit more... Maybe... We could have sorted something out, but we didn't. We came in 3-0, and we were lucky to get away with 3-0. And Bill came in, and he was effing and jeffing, and the names he was calling us, and you're not going out, needn't think you're going out tonight, I'm telling you this, I'm telling you that, you're all a bunch of this, and you're a bunch of that. And all of a sudden, I'd had number 7 on my back, that, so you're changing in your rotation, and I'm just sat with my back forward, and the guy who had number 6 on his shirt decided to go, "Fucking shut up, will you?" And the place just went as quiet as you like, and McGarry just looked, and I'm sat in front of the person who's just said it, Derek Jefferson.
Derek Jefferson.
Jeffo, he stood up, and he's looked at me, McGarry, and I'm thinking, well, it wasn't me, boss.
I didn't think it was me.
So I've sort of leaned back, and there's Jeffo stood up with a towel around him, and he says, Who said that? And Jeff O goes, "I said it." He says, "Have you heard yourself?" And well, McGarry just went off at one, and he went out. He slammed the door shut, and we all, in spite of what McGarry said, we all ended up in Kevin Beattie's nightclub, which was crap.
What the club was?
Yeah.
After all that.
And we were in there, and then while we were all sat in there, we were all saying, "Look, he can't treat us like this. He can't. This is ridiculous. He's treating us like
one
like
beer, kids. Two beer, three beer."
Oh, absolutely. And this is that, you know. And so we're all there. Well, you know, and fair play to Bobby Gould. Bobby Gould said, "Look, it's all right us sitting here and saying this now. We've got to get the boss together, and we've got to say, look, we're in the mire. We need to pull together to get out of this," quite rightly. And
so it was a team bonding meeting, really. It wasn't a piece of...
Yeah, but then we said, right, okay. And then somebody said, well, this isn't very good here. Is there anywhere else to go? And somebody said, yeah, there's a great club over in Colchester.
So
we all said, right, we're all getting taxis over to Colchester. Nobody drop out. Nobody do this. And I think 5 of us ended up over in Colchester. And I think it was myself, Richie, Norman Bell. I think Colin was with us, actually. I think Colin was in the squad. I can't remember. But yeah. To cut a long story short, we forced this meeting, or asked McGarry to attend a meeting when we got home on the Thursday, or the first morning training after that. So, and Bobby says, "Look, will you do me a favour? Will you stand up and speak on behalf of the young professionals, the younger?" I said, "Yeah, okay, Bob. Well, you know the fact that no one, you can't feel it, go and knock his door," which he didn't. As a young man, I didn't feel like I'd go and knock Bill's door and come out with any, you know, so look, I think I need this boss. Or... So I said, okay. So we asked Bill to come down, and the place was, we had all the apprentices, everybody, we had them all there. And fair play to Bobby Gould. Bob got up and did a speech, and he says, "Look, boss, you know, we want to have this because we feel that nothing's getting sorted. You know, we're all a bit disappointed the way you spoke to us the other night, and we know that we were rubbish, but you know, we feel we all need to do this." And McGarry went, "Go on, Bob," and so Gouldy carried on and saying that, you know, and levelled a few accusations against the boss. And he says, "I mean, the young professionals don't feel they can go and knock your door. Is that right, Jerry?" And I'm now up, and I'm saying, "Well, I think boss, as a young player who's been put into the side and who's come up through the thing, I says, there's a very fine line between fear and respect, and sometimes I ask myself, I says, I look at young people here and." I says, "And who are here?" And I think I could point to any one of these and say it's closer to fear than it is to respect, you know, at this moment in time. And I always remember pointing to this young lad from Birmingham, a young lad called Gary Tysel, who if you spoke to Gary in the morning, he used to go blood red, and he was frightened of his own shadow. I thought, well, he's a banker, he'll say, "Yeah, I'm frightened of you, boss," you know. And And so I said, any one of these lads will tell you. And I remember Gary got up and he pointed at Gary, young Gary, and went, are you frightened of me, son? Gary went, no, boss. No.
Discredited the whole argument.
Yeah, and I said, well, cheers, with all due respect, I think you are, Gary. But you know, we look, boss, you know, what we're trying to do is we want to get this right. You know, we're all in it together and things like this. And Bob said, look, we've all done a lot of talking now, boss. I think it's time to give you a chance to speak. McGarry stood up and he went, me? He says, do you know what I think? You want my opinion? And Bob says, well, yeah, we've held the floor for long enough, boss. And he goes, I think you're all a bunch of fucking cheats. And turned around, kicked the door out and walked out and walked off.
And that was the end of that?
Goldie stood up and said, well, that went well, didn't it? You know, and...
Do you think he was quite unapproachable then?
I think he was. I think he was a good football man, but a very poor man manager.
Yeah,
and I think he proved that along the years. But he was proper old school. I mean, you know.
I mean, with the first team, he had the pick of some good players, didn't he?
Well, so, he signed some good players because he was a good manager. He was a good football manager, but he proved. I think he was Bill Shankly without the niceties that went along with Bill, and
yeah.
And Bill Shankly encouraged the loyalty, and I think he had a side to him that Bill McGarry didn't.
Yeah,
and I think that was a side that a warm side to him that the players, you know, I think they would have run through brick walls. But the one thing I would say is I don't think you'd ever get any player who played for Bill McGarry who would say, I was prepared to run through a brick wall for Bill.
Yeah,
that would have respected you.
Yeah, you wouldn't have really got the thanks, the gratitude, no, the adulation for him.
So. I don't think so.
You touched upon Liverpool. You played against a certain. I think he was making his debut, wasn't he, in the Central League?
Yeah, I was. That was a tale. I was once again. I was. It was my set. I'd made my debut in the 75-76 season, and then we started the 76. We got relegated that year.
Nothing to do with you, Jerry, by the way.
It's all Jason.
Yeah.
But we, then the next season, obviously, I started the season in the first team, and then Sammy Chung was manager now. McGarry had the sack.
You'd saw him off.
We got rid of him. And then we started that season, and there was players like myself, Norman Bell, you know, second line professionals, Morris Daly, people like Morris, and to a certain extent, young Martin Patchin as well, who'd had tastes of the first team, and you know, were desperate for more. You know, and we were having to play, and I remember, and we were playing. I remember we were reporting to play away at Liverpool, in the reserves, and. And as I got there, Willie Carr was having we were playing Millwall at home in the first team, and we got there in the morning to travel to Liverpool, and Willie had had a fitness test and failed it. And Willie came out and he went, "You're going to be stopping here. You're playing here today." I thought, "Oh, brilliant!" Like, you know,
first team yeah.
Again on the it was on. I remember it was on ATV soccer. I thought, fantastic,
brilliant.
You know, so I'm sat there thinking, "Oh, I ain't got to travel now. Brilliant." I'm waiting, and then Brian Garvey came in and went, right, come on, everybody up now, we're leaving now, and I'm thinking, well, I'm not,
I'm in the first team.
And he says, come on, Jerry, come on, I'm thinking, well, when are they going to tell me, and now he got me up, and then, lo and behold, he said to a young guy, Kenny Todd, he said, Ken, you're stopping here, you're making your debut in the first team, so I thought, oh, right, okay, so
Willie.
Cheers, Will. Yeah, so I've got on the couch, and I thought, right, okay, well, could be worse places to play than Anfield on a Saturday afternoon, you know, and so up we draw, and I think, right, I've got to put this behind me, and I've got to go and, you know, show them what I can do, but still in a frame of mind where I was disappointed, you know, and we get up there, and so I'm thinking to myself, right, come on, you've got to go out and play, and I gets out there and we starts playing, and I remember they announced two young men making their debut for Liverpool reserves today. Blah 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 blah. I didn't take much notice, but I certainly did after about 15 minutes. because the kid playing opposite me was none other than a 16-year-old Sammy Lee, who was absolutely outstanding and really? The fittest kid I'd ever seen. I think after about 15 minutes, I grabbed hold of him. I went, kid, slow down. You know, yeah. You're having a great game.
I should have been in the first team today.
He told me in no uncertain terms where to go in his scouse invective. You know, and but obviously went on to have a great player. Great player, but he was the last thing I needed on that particular day. But he was outstanding, fantastic.
Who was the other player making his debut?
I can't remember. I don't think he was a good little player. I remember he played well, but I don't think he ever. I can't remember. Jason.
Wasn't someone like Kenny Dalglish?
Fowler or something like that.
You mentioned Brian Garvey. So was he a coach at the time at Wolves?
Well, I always remember the two Bryans came in. There were Brian Garvey and Brian Owen. Brian Owen actually was the England youth coach, and I liked Brian. I had a lot of time for Brian Owen. Not so much Brian Garvey. We clashed, and it, in fact, going back to that story about Brian Garvey, I think Colin alluded to it in his podcast, but the Central League was a great league to play in. Mm-hmm. Absolutely fantastic league.
Because you play at all the grounds, wouldn't you? Like Anfield, Old Trafford.
I'll tell you when it was a great league when you were 16, 17, looking to make the step up.
Yeah.
And it wasn't such a good league when you felt that you should be... You should have been playing in the first team and things like this, and because you'd have this mix of disgruntled, not so much me, but I was still a young kid and I was still trying to make a name for myself. But you'd play against proper seasoned professionals, yeah. I made my full Central League debut at the end of that first season. We played on the last game of the season. We played Leeds at home, and Terry Cooper was left back.
Yeah,
for Leeds.
England international.
Roy, Teddy had an injury and he was coming back from. But there was Teddy. I remember Teddy Cooper was playing. I remember Sprake was in goal. Roy Ellum centre half. Mick Bates.
Flipping heck. You know, that's a decent team.
I'm a 16-year-old kid and I'm trying to think of some of the others. But you know, and that's almost as good as making a first team debut. You know, some of the people that you play, and that they. Colin also alluded to you could learn things and not just in terms of how to play the game, but also some of the darker arts as well, you know.
Yeah,
things
tricks
like
of the
that.
Trade.
Oh yeah, yeah.
What like?
Well, you know, just how to handle yourself, and I mean, I can't remember the name of it. He was a lad at Bolton. This was later on, and. Now, funny enough, I always remember because until I got in the first team, my mother and father really never came to a lot of games, you know, considering. And we'd moved then to Bother West Park. But
you've been at all the money you was earning, money, Jerry.
I remember my father had come to watch us, and we were playing Bolton, and I can't remember who centre half, and I'd been buzzing around him trying to get the ball away from him. He'd played the ball back to his keeper, and. Just as I'm going to run away, he's just flicked me in the face as we're running away. And I thought to myself, what? And the red mist just came down. And I always remember, I run straight after him. And the best I could do was boot him straight up the backside, right in front of the referee.
So the referee blew the whistle.
And the kid's, what's going on? You know, and the referee's turned around, seen me, and he's just said, get off. So I walked into a volley of abuse from my father, from the coach.
But once again, that's just lack of experience, isn't
well,
it?
Because he was a seasoned pro. And
so, you know, slapping him around the face, you know he's going to react.
He completely, you know, had me, done me like a kipper.
Back to, obviously, the story obviously I'm alluding to with Brian Garvey was you had a bit of a fallout with him over at the racecourse, didn't you, Jerry?
Well, yeah. Well, the issue for me was that season where, you know, the previous season, the youth team, which I was non-eligible for, I was too old, the youth, Brian, did a great job and got the youth team to the final of the FA Youth Cup, and they got beat by our near neighbours. the Baggies. And and Brian then stepped up to be reserve team coach. And I think a few of us that obviously were too old, I'm talking about, once again, the likes of Norman Bell, the likes of Maurice Daly, the likes of myself, a young lad, there was a few lads there, Alan Niven, Sammy Wright, you know, lads like this who felt, you know, that we were, our careers were trying to make our way in the game, and I think a few of us felt that Brian, at the end of the reserve game, you know, he would go in with glowing reports for the kids that had made the youth team, the step up from the youth team to the reserves, and he was plugging them, and he was going to Chungy and saying, you know, these kids are worth it, you know, blah blah blah, and I think we felt a bit like Brian was selling us a bit short, and so I didn't really see eye to eye. I didn't like his training. I loved Brian Owen's training. I thought Brian was a proper bloke, proper trainer. I felt Brian was not for me. And the one we trained with the first team one Friday. There was myself, Kenny Todd, Norman Bell, and Chungy put the squad up and said, look, you guys are going to be with the reserves. You may as well go and down to the race course and train with Brian down at the race course. So we said, right, all right, okay. So the three of us ran down, jogged down to the race course, which was never the nicest training environment. I think it was midwinter anyhow, and you know, minus 14 in the middle of the race course. And as we jogged down, Brian had got the lads in a shooting drill, you know, and we're running down and we're getting down. We just, as somebody shot and missed, we caught the ball and we've gone to take our line up and play the ball in, have it played back to you, and then you take a shot. And Brian's, he just said to us, he says, well, what do you think you're doing? So, well, we're coming to shoot, Brian, you know, and we've been sent down from the, well, you can't just join in like that. Stay behind the goal until we finish this drill. Myself, Norman and Kenny Todd, we went behind the goal, so we were catching the balls and throwing them back to the lads, and then Brian decides to set a couple of teams up, six-a-side teams, and as I've already said, it was extremely cold down there, so we started the game going and things like this, and Brian was always one for stopping the game and pointing out, you know, extremely lengthy tirades of what you'd done wrong and what you hadn't done wrong. And he had Big Baba Hissel, I remember, who was on my side, and he'd stopped the game and he was telling Bob he hadn't done this, he hadn't done that, and we've got the ball back now and we're ready to start. And he's telling it. And Bob's going, all right, Brian, I get it, I understand. And yeah, but you keep doing it, you know, and yeah, I get it, Brian, like, you know. And so I just shouted over, Brian, he's got it. He understands. Can we move on? Because we're all freezing here, like, you know. And I think it just all culminated. We didn't like one another, and he come over to me and he called me a few things and said, I don't know. You think you are? You think you come here and running this and doing this and doing that? And I just saw. I saw red and
again,
and let him have a volley of abuse, which I shouldn't have done. In fact, I think it culminated in me dropping my shorts and mooning at him. And
as you do.
Unbelievably, he sent me back to the ground. And
strange.
I mean, some people have got no sense of humour. Coaches, I'm not being funny.
You didn't have to run back there, did you?
Yeah, I had to run back to the thing. And of course, as I'm running back, I'm thinking, what have you done? Why did you react like that? You know, and when you got a bit of time, and as soon as I got back into the. I got back into the ground and I just went and had a shower, and by the time I went out the shower, the lads had got back, and Sammy called me in and sent me home for a week with no wages, and you know.
So you got banned for, what was your wage?
I was suspended and sent home, and then so, I had to go home. I was still living with parents, and I had to explain that I didn't have to go in next week, and you know, and why. So that didn't go down well, I can tell you, but.
So we've spoke about a lot of the people you didn't get on with, but so I know you've got two good mates, and I still see you with them now, and obviously every time you're with them you roll back the years. A couple of good lads, Jeff Palmer and Lofty.
Yeah, well, as I say, Jeff, when I first signed, for some reason, I mean, Jeff was just got in the first team, was playing in the first team, and I got on great with Jeff and Barry Powell. They were big mates, and I just got on with them, and for 2 years I Jeff and me were best buddies. You know, we went everywhere together, and then
you still live near him now, don't you?
Yeah, Jeff. In fact, my wife's shop is in Chapel Lane in Cotswold, and Jeff lives in Chapel Lane, and he's about 8 doors up from our shop, so I still see a lot of Jeff.
You still got the ball? Cause you used to go up the ball, didn't you, on a Friday? Yeah, you yeah. Dales.
Well,
Jeff Farmer.
I don't think they're allowed anymore.
Oh, aren't they? Aren't they allowed for being egg? I've asked them to the podcast, and they said, oh, we've got to ask our missus if we can come.
No, I mean, I used to see a fair bit of them in the village. I still see a lot of Steve and Jeff, but don't really socialise as much as... I mean, they're busy lads. We're all busy, like, you know.
It's flipping Jeff, busy playing golf.
Well,
so
Dale's is... Steve, he's... he does a lot. He's a good lad like that, Steve.
Yeah.
He does go out and do a lot for the community.
So, Lofty, obviously... We, look, you know, Lofty's one we've got to get on the podcast, really. Obviously, I know Phil very well. Not as well as you.
Mm.
Get into any scrapes ever?
What could you mean, Jason?
I wouldn't possibly know.
Well, I think there's a famous story of we basically we played away at Sheffield Wednesday in the reserves one night, or one afternoon, and we came back, and we were supposed to be meeting Mike Bailey. Mike had said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. When you get back, I'll meet you in the press wine bar."
The press for a bit.
So we said okay. So we went to the press, and I'm not proud of this or anything, please. So I mean, some of it's quite funny, but it's not something I'd recommend. We went up to the press, and no sign of Mike. So and there was certainly no mobile phones in there.
Yeah.
So I think we asked the gaffer behind there. Can we use your phone? Can we just ring? I ring Mickey Bailey, and we rung Mick, and Mick says, oh, look, there's no way I can go up there. I've had a drink this afternoon, and I can't meet you now. So I said, okay. So me and Phil sat chewing the cud of how the game had gone, and etc. And one drink led to another and another, and like a complete and utter idiot, and as I said, I'm not proud of it, jumped in a car.
Actually, I just want to step in there. In your absolute defence, I mean, obviously, you're not condoning anything like this. Lofty didn't drive,
no.
And to this day, he's never had a driving licence. Well, so he'd go on the piss with anyone, wouldn't he?
There's a funny little caveat to this story as it went on, as it played out.
So you got in the car, which you obviously not proud of.
So I got in the car and drove. Lofty lived in Fordowes. He's still where he does now. We've drove down the Stafford Road, and as I'm coming out of town, I've hit a curb, and one of the tyres... Well, in fact, I think both tyres went that side.
I mean, what year was that?
76.
So you couldn't even blame the fact you was on your mobile phone, could you, Jerry?
No. So, and we were coming down the Stafford Road, literally just the other side of the Molyneux, and all of a sudden there's a police car behind us and pulls us in, and there was a pub there, I think it was called the Barley Mow then, so we pulled him.
Oh God, the Barley Mow?
And he said,
that's gone?
That, yeah, and he said, that's where he pulled us on, and he says, look, he says, have you two lads had a drink? No, you know.
Flipping it, you've literally gone 200 yards from the press.
I know, it wasn't far. And I said, well, we've had one, like, you know. I said, well, I'm just taking this young man back to his house. And he said, well, I'm sorry. He said, well, you know, we have to breathalyse you. So he did. And obviously, I was over. And they arrested me and put me in the back of the car. He did. He then rang, because apparently it was by law you had to have 2 arresting officers. So he rings for another guy, and this other guy turns up, and he's put me in the back. The car, he's still outside talking to Phil. So this guy comes, and basically, as this guy comes, leaves his car, and he gets in the front. I'm sat in the back, and the other policeman's in the front. So, and they just shut the door on Phil. So Phil's tapping the window. He goes, oh, he says, what are you doing? I says, look, and they kept calling Phil. I always remember they kept calling him Sunbeam. And by now they'd realised we were Wolves players. And Phil's going, look, I want to get in. I'm not letting you take him to the police station on his own. I'm coming. Norma's going, no, you're not. He says, you get yourself off home. And he says, how am I supposed to get home? And I said, the bloke said, there's a bus stop over there. Phil went, bus stop? He says, I ain't been on a bus. He says, in 15 years. He says, I ain't getting on a bus. He says, what are you talking about? He says, I'm coming with you. And the bloke's going, look, get yourself off home now or I'll arrest you. So Phil's going, well, you'll have to arrest me then, what, you know. And by now, he's gently swaying the whole police. I'm sat in the back of the police car and he's just swaying.
By this time you're sober enough.
Swaying backwards and forwards. And I'm actually saying to him, I says, look, please. I says, just drive it. He doesn't need, don't, there's nothing Phil can do. Take me. But Phil won't let him go. And he's insistent. He wants to come to the police station. He doesn't want to leave me. And basically, the one driving said to the other one, he says, right, get out and arrest him. And the other policeman turned to the first policeman and said, are you joking? He says, what are you on about? He says, get out and arrest him. He says, you get out and arrest him. He says, he's 6 foot bloody four. He says, he's built like a brick outhouse. He says, you get out and arrest him. And I said, he's all right. Anyhow, cut a long story short, the one outside, look, if you carry on, we're going to have to arrest you and put you in the back of the car. He says, great, put me in, get me in there. In he gets by the side of me and he's winking at me and I told you I wouldn't leave you on your own. And I'm going, why didn't you just go home? And
Mickey Bailey on the other end, he's on his third scotch, he's thinking,
So we were taken to Red Lion Street, locked up. Lofty's shouting and because they went to him and they said, we need to take your belt off and take your laces out your shoe, and he bust out laughing. My laces? So you're on about? He said, well, we don't want you causing yourself any harm or hanging yourself. Hanging myself in my laces.
I mean, just... did you have to miss training the next day?
Well, we had to go in and see, we had to see Harry Marshall.
Who
was the chairman. We got called in and Harry wasn't very happy, obviously.
Yeah.
We apologised and, blamed Mick Bailey profusely.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But, he's all told.
And then it was all over the ATV news that night.
Oh, was it on the news?
Oh, well, yeah, it was, And even then, I can remember years later, do you remember Simon Bates? That he used to do the Golden Year and things like this. And he always, when it came to that this particular day, and this, he always used to come up the Wolves goalkeeper that was arrested for turning a police car over.
And they didn't mention you, Jerry?
No.
See, there you... I mean...
Story of my life, that is, Jason.
Well, you left in May 1978.
Yeah, I mean, basically, what happened was I'd not felt very well in training and things like this. And I always remember we'd had a really heavy training session and we got soaked, really soaked. And I can remember feeling I'm coming down with a chilly and I feel really, I don't feel well at all. And I think I had a couple of days off and it wasn't long after I'd been suspended. I always remember that. I hadn't been back long from the from when they'd sent me home, and I came back and I started to feel really unwell. And then my ankle started to swell and I basically got diagnosed with rheumatic fever.
Okay.
And it had attacked my ankle the worst out of all the joints that I had, which funnily enough is probably the strongest joint I've got now. And I have to say, the club were fantastic. We made they at first they were treating it like an orthopaedic injury, and I was seeing orthopaedic surgeons and.
So it wasn't. It was sort of almost misdiagnosed at first.
A little bit, but then we and the physio at the time was a guy called Kevin Walters, top lad, Kevin, really good boy. And
is he the guy with the curly hair? The really, really bushy curly hair.
No, that was Eddie.
Sorry.
That was years later. No, Kevin was actually brother of Julie Walters. He's a Birmingham lad.
All right.
And Kevin was a really top guy, and Christ, I'd spent.
after all, through all this, I spent about 18 months with Kevin trying to get fit and things like this. But when they after about 2 months, they sent me and Kevin to go and see a rheumatic specialist. And I went over to Droitwich, and I always remember we were sat waiting to see the specialist. Of course, I'm sitting there thinking, am I ever going to, you know, is this ever going to, you know, be
he just wasn't clearing up.
And I always remember we were in the waiting room waiting to see this guy, and I looked out. I was looking out, and there was these two young lads, and they were in a plaster cast almost from their neck, all the way down their body, and they were outside trying to kick a ball about on this grass. And I remember just looking at them, and as we were waiting to see the specialist. When he eventually called us in, they wouldn't let Kevin in, and it caused a big furore. Kevin says, "Well, hang on a sec, I'm a professional person. I'm responsible for Jerry." And the bloke says, "Well, I want to." The surgeon says, "I want to talk to him on his own. So, can you just leave us for a moment?" And I was sat outside waiting to go in to see this guy. And there was just the nursery man. I remember saying to her, "I said, those two young fellas. I said, out there, they were probably." No more than seven.
Mm.
And they were twins. I didn't realise at the time. I should have done, but I didn't. And I said, "Those two young fellas." I said, what exactly is wrong with them that they've got all the plastic?" And she says, they've rheumatoid arthritis. She said they were born with it. And I says, "Right." I said, "Well, when can they take that come off and blah blah blah?" And she says, "Well, probably never." She says, She says, "They will probably, their life expectancy is no more than 14. And I can remember looking out at these two lads. And I thought, and it really put it all in perspective for me. I just looked and I thought, well, why am I sitting here feeling sorry for myself?
Yeah.
You know, and I remember looking out at these lads. And then I went through to the guy and he examined me. They did tests on me, and I had to go back and see him again with Kevin and I know it sounds a bit silly, but even as I was sat there, and he actually said to me, he said, I don't think you'll ever play professional sport again. You, I don't think the joint will stand it." And I thought to myself, well, I'm still in a far better position than those two young lads, or, you know, and I was devastated, obviously, you know, and in all fairness, the club still gave me probably another 12 months to try and...
And you couldn't get right?
No, it was getting close at times where I was having injection after injection and things like this.
So you're not playing at that point?
I wasn't playing at all. I wasn't capable.
So you left in...
And then a decision was taken between myself and Sammy. They paid me an amount to pay my contract up, and they couldn't have been fairer.
The club. Really?
No, couldn't have been fairer.
And to be honest, then, that was really, for want of a better expression, that was almost the end, because I know you signed for Hereford, who was still a league club. You
well, I didn't immediately. I mean, basically what happened was there was a guy who was a local physio who'd done a little bit of work on this particular type of thing. And he asked me, a guy called Derek Potter, and Derek asked me, he said, would you be prepared to let me treat you and see? And I said, "Well, you can do, Daddy, yeah, you know." And anyhow, this guy, no payment whatsoever. I used to go to his house, and he had these salts, and he used to bathe my ankle in these salts, and then he'd massage it, and then I couldn't believe how much better it was feeling, and he said to me, "I'm going to train you," and we trained for about. We trained about four nights a week, and he got me back to a really good standard of fitness. And I thought to myself, maybe I could. And at the time, Mick Bailey had taken over at Hereford.
All right.
As manager, and Derek knew Mick quite well, and he says, "Really, you ought to give Jerry a pre-season and see what he can do for you." So I went and. They were fourth division then, and with all due respect, I was the fittest one there. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe the standard. And we played a couple of pre-season games, and then Mick says, "I'm gonna pick you in the first game." I played a couple of reserve team games first, and then he said, "I'm gonna put you in." And he put me in for the one game, and we played Bradford City away, and I thought I'd played well. And then he had a lad called Steve Emery who'd been suspended, and I'd played where Steve had played, and Steve went to Derby and played. He was a good player, Steve, nice kid. And he put Steve straight back in and put me sub. And then he said to me, and then I went to him because I was driving from Wolverhampton to Hereford every day. In my own car and paying my own petrol, and I said to Mick, I says, look, I could do some expenses, Mick, you know, for time. I think he was giving me 40 quid or something
a week,
you know, and I think Mick saw it as he was giving me a chance, you know, and things like this, and then he'd name me as in the reserves. We were playing in the combination league against Birmingham away, and I said, look, Mick, if I'm not going to get paid, or I'd be better off going and playing non-league and doing this and doing that. And he said, well, just make sure you're at Birmingham on the on Saturday. And I said, well, no. I said, if you say to me, you can put me up in a hotel a couple of nights a week, and so I refused to play on the, which once again I'm not proud of that. I refused to play against Birmingham reserves, and we parted ways, and I signed for Worcester City, who were then in the very last Southern League Premier,
because
the Southern League Premier and the Northern League Premier leagues were amalgamating and becoming the first Alliance League the next season, which is now the Vanarama, the National League, you know. But it was the first big non-league, and I signed. I remember I went, and Nobby Clark, who was a legend in non-league circles. he asked me to sign and things like this, and I said, okay, I'll come and have a look and everything. And I went training on the Thursday night, and he said, will you come Saturday? I said, yeah. And he rung me on the Friday night, and he says, I'm going to play you Saturday. And we had Barrow. It's Barrow at home. So I said, right, okay. I says, when will we discuss? Well, he says, let's play this game. And anyhow, I went, and Colin talked about Graham Allman, who'd managed him at... Graham was playing for us then, and he became a really good friend, Graham. But I was gobsmacked at the standard of this league, and some of the players we had at Worcester City could have played league football.
Oh, really?
Absolutely no problem. And I remember I went, and there was about 3,500 at Worcester that day, and we beat Barrow 2-0, and I made the one for Graham, and about 5-10 minutes from the end, I intercepted a pass on the halfway line, and I just went on a run. I beat about 3 or 4, only the keeper to beat. I sold the keeper a dummy. You know when Hoddle does
the shots? Yeah.
Very similar to that. And I just dropped, slotted it in, and so from that, he offered me a contract straight away, and I signed, and I had nearly 3 seasons at Worcester. But while I was at Worcester, I completely mangled my other knee. I went into a tackle with the lad, and that was... I've never felt the same after that. When I was at Worcester and I was playing really well, and I was top scorer and from midfield, and at the time, I think I'd played about 4 games at the start of that season, and Nobby came to me and he says, look, he says, the Albion want you. Ron Atkinson's very interesting.
So there was a chance to go back in the league?
Oh, yeah. And he says, Mick Brown was here. He says, watching you against Norwich the other night. And I played really well. And I actually thought to myself, can I go and play for the Albion? I was still Wolves lad through and through, you know. And I thought, I'm not sure I could go and play for the Albion. But it was league football, and Albion were ahead of Wolves at that particular time. You're talking about 81 then. And I thought to myself, and I knew I was pretty pally with Derek Statham, and I knew Brian Robson as well. And I thought, well, yeah. And then we were playing in a FA Cup fourth qualifying round that Saturday against Malvern Town away, and I completely and utterly just done my knee completely. And
that was the end.
And no, it wasn't the end. I played non-league for years, but never felt the same after that, and I lost the chance of that, you know. So when Colin Brazier says I've had nothing but bad luck,
yeah,
I mean, look, you come and speak to me.
Well, Jerry, obviously, just going back to the start, look at the Irish. Obviously, the Irish blood in you, but you know what, Jerry, you've lived the dream. You've you know, look. Obviously, this is a Wolves podcast. You played 11 games for the Wolves. You've wore that shirt 11 times. Not only that, there's been some great stories. You played with some great players.
I wouldn't change a thing, Jase.
I was just going to say,
if I had any regrets,
I was going to say, as a closing point, is there any regrets? Anything you'd change apart from upsetting Brian Garvey? Apart from upsetting Bill McGarry? Apart from upsetting the police officer? Apart from upsetting?
You're starting to say.
I'm joking.
Paint a picture of you, Jase. No, my biggest regret is that I didn't go on to play 100 games, 150. It's always been something with me that if I'd have stayed fit, I felt I would have got that amount of games under my belt, you know, particularly when I saw some of the players that came through just after me and obviously later on, you know.
That you could have still done a
job. Oh yeah, I think that if I'd have stayed fit and I think Sammy Chung rated me, you know, so I think that I'd have had a good chance while Sammy was still there to have played a few games. And that's just the biggest regret, that I just didn't get the chance to you know, rack a good few games up, you know. I'd have loved that.
Well, Jerry, like, once again, I'd have given my right arm to have done what you've done. Obviously, it ended cruelly with obviously an injury or an illness, which you wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't take you out of the game.
I think that was the thing, that it was just no one really knew, you know, I've got nothing but the Wolves, you know, were great to me. They gave me every chance to get over it, and
yeah,
I've got nothing but the Wolves owe me nothing, absolutely nothing, you know. So.
Well, Jerry, I want to thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Once again, it's been a very, very interesting interview. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, James.
And we'll speak again soon. Cheers, Jerry.
Thank you, sir.
Cheers, mate.